rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Conley, Judge Smith, Judge Riley. The Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. Our first case this morning is A23-0615, State of Minnesota versus Justin, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Holinka. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument, and finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. When you're ready, just approach the microphone. The podium goes up and down, and you can adjust it to your level, and just please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good morning. My name is Peter Dahlquist. May it please the court, I represent Justin Holinka in this matter. This case, from its inception, was about identity. It was about identity of who the alleged seller was. There was a contested omnibus hearing. It was that issue there. Was
I thought it was about the state's rush to justice.
I don't know if I quite characterize it that way, Your Honor, but...
Well, trial counsel did, so...
Trial counsel did, I agree. But I think the real issue was identity, and that was the contested issue at omnibus. It was the contested issue at trial. It's the reason we're here today. The issue is the manner in which the state proved the element of identity at trial and whether or not that was constitutional. I think one factor that's fundamentally important to that orientation is the fact that at trial, the two CIs, when testifying under oath, did not identify Holinka as the seller. And it's through that lens that then Investigator Soderholm testified and relayed information that he received from Investigator Cook, a different investigator who didn't testify, about the identity of Holinka. So, because there was no objection, the standard is plain error here, but the reason that this is plain error and the reason it was so plain is given that procedural posture. There was a contested omnibus hearing, and the issue was, I think to use the word lineup is probably not the best word to use. The state ruled that the method of identification used by the state at that point with the CIs was impermissibly suggestive, but also ruled that the CIs had an ability to identify at trial or had a foundation to identify at trial the seller. So the court knew that that was the central issue. That was really the only contested issue or element at trial was identity. There's no question there was a sale. There's no question where the site was. The issue was identity. And once the Crees don't identify Holinka as the seller, it becomes even more important how that issue of identity is going to be proved.
We read a lot, so I might have missed it. I don't really remember you making an argument about the procedural posture and the omnibus hearing, et cetera, as playing a role in our evaluation now of this case, in your brief.
I didn't raise it as an issue, but I think it's plain.
So it's the context you're giving us now.
It's the context I'm giving you now.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So assuming that there was plain error for a moment, let's go to prejudice. When I look at your brief, out-of-court statements that you're challenging, and the plain error is around the admission of the out-of-court statement. The out-of-court statement is a statement from two investigating officers that they talked to Cook, and Cook said, that's Holinka, okay, based on the description that they gave, a guy from Jackson who blah, blah, blah. And one of the descriptions, I think, even included his license plate number.
That was after the fact, Your Honor.
That they told... him, let's see, Lacan said, I gave my note that I had of that license plate to Soderholm. Okay, sorry, my apologies. Yep, okay, so then they talked to Cook. And then your brief says, so the out-of-court statement is Cook's statement, that's Holinka, right?
Exactly, yes.
Okay, and then in your brief you say, in contrast, Holinka concedes that Cook's out-of-court statement of his observation of the black Honda at Holinka's house in Jackson is furthering the investigation. So that's okay that they testified to Cook saying, hey, I saw this car in his driveway with this license plate. And that license plate then they know matched essentially with an error what they saw at the scene. How did the out-of-court, like if we eliminate the out-of-court statements that's Holinka in my view, they still have the license plate. They still know it was a person from Jackson by virtue of the seller, et cetera. It seems hard to see how it matters once you eliminate that out-of-court statement that they think it's Holinka when the rest of it ties up to be him.
The distinction is the issue of identity of the seller. So
no, I know that. So and the seller is the person they think who was driving a black vehicle from Jackson with license plate X. And even excluding that testimony, they know that it's a person of this physical description with his license plate from Jackson.
So I'm going to answer your question. It's just going to be a little bit broad.
Okay.
So the issue here, like I said, it's identity. Mm-hmm. And the only issue that actually is identity of the seller, the only direct evidence of the seller, is that identification by Cook. The rest of the information, there was a car at the scene. It's unclear. That's investigation. It's also information that's accessible through public databases. If they go back after the fact and look up Holinka, what was he driving, they can see the car and things of that nature. So that's where that doesn't prove that Holinka was the seller. It's circumstantial evidence that his car was present. It's arguably circumstantial that he was present with that car. Those two, I would disagree, are the same. I don't think they're the same thing. But the issue of identity, that's where that's testimonial, and that's testimonial investigation that Investigator Soderholm is seeking from Investigator Cook, and that's what makes it a Confrontation Clause violation once that's admitted into evidence without Cook testifying and without him being subject to cross-examination.
Well, let me ask you this. Your client's trial counsel knew how to object on hearsay grounds and did, except when he didn't, which are the statements that you're pointing to. And the state's argument is that was part of the trial strategy of the counsel. And how do you respond to that argument?
So the state pointed that out, and I agree that he did object at other points to hearsay evidence.
And any first-year law student would be able to say, yep, that's hearsay, objection.
I agree with that, Your Honor, and I think that actually ties back into the point here, is that once the CIs don't identify Holinka as the seller, any identification of Holinka is clearly objectionable. And so for an inability for him to notice that and to fight tooth and nail to keep any identification of Holinka out, it's mind-boggling. So my point is you can say the state can argue that he objected at other points, but to not object at the fundamentally most important point, that's where it's problematic. And it's almost as if the defense counsel went into trial thinking that the CIs are going to identify Holinka, and when they don't, he can't pivot off this thought process.
And that's why you don't think that on the ineffective assistance of trial counsel that it needs to go back for further making a bigger record.
Exactly. I think it's clear. I mean, I don't think there's any strategy that makes any sense that's reasonable at all where you would allow an out-of-court identification of your client when the issue is identity. The only contested issue and element is identity. It's completely unreasonable trial strategy. And to not be able to cross-examine that identification, again, is completely unreasonable. You don't need a supplemental hearing to find that. There's no reasonable trial strategy where that's the case.
Well, I mean, but if Cook did testify, I mean, okay, let's go with that. If your client or the state subpoenaed Cook to testify, or your client subpoenaed him to testify, and Cook testified, oh yeah, that's the tall guy. Yep, that's him, all right. I mean, isn't that even worse for your client? Because then you've got Cook saying, it's the tall guy, and now in court, personally saying, there he is, he's a drug dealer, he's been a drug dealer a lot. I mean, that seems worse. So, I mean, I can see a reason not to go there. And better to have him off the stand and then just say, oh, it's confirmation bias, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So why am I wrong, Mr. Dahlquist?
Because there would be an ability to challenge his Cook's testimony, his motive for testifying. He is a drug investigator in a small community. And
so presumably he would know who the drug dealers are.
Presumably, but presumably also...
Which is even worse. But, I mean, it's a small community. There's only a couple of them. And we all know the guy who's 6 feet tall or 6 feet five.
The other issue, though, is would be the admissibility and the foundation of that testimony. I mean, there's no indication from the record at all that Holink has been charged elsewhere. So what's the basis for this identification? And that would be a fight that would be had in pretrial proceedings, and that doesn't occur.
But isn't the testimony really, I know we keep saying it's the identification as if he's saying that's the guy. And I understand that that's how it comes in. But in terms of the investigation, the officers called the law enforcement in Jackson where they knew the person came from to deliver drugs. And then they say, do you have anyone there who resembles a 6 foot five person, you know, who, you know, you have experience with, who is involved in drugs? Yes, there's someone who resembles that here. Oh, okay, will you go look at, you know, the car, take a look at the house? Yep, the car that is there is the same one that was there. I mean, it's sort of just how it comes in. They're not really saying, that's the guy, I saw him. They are saying, here's someone who resembles that, and then it gives them somewhere to focus. Is there something wrong? What's wrong with that if the testimony came in like that?
I think the problem with that is it's kind of you're backdooring in investigation when it's really testimonial. And there's language in the Fields case that says that officers can't provide identification evidence when it's the course of an investigation. So
they could have though testified simply that we contacted law enforcement in Jackson, you know, having learned that the drug dealer came from there. Thereafter, we asked Investigator Cook to go look at the car. Investigator Cook saw the car that matched that. That would all be okay.
That would be fine.
Okay, so as long as we don't know why they asked Investigator Cook to go look at that particular, well, they already knew the license plate number, I guess. Like you say, they could have looked it up, the license plate they saw, and then said, go look at his house. So they could have even said that. The license plate there belonged to Holinka. I asked Cook to go look at Holinka's house. We saw that his car was parked there. That would all be okay.
I agree.
What they can't do is have Holinka say resembles, or I think it was him based on your description.
That's exactly. I think that's the part that needs to be subject to cross-examination. And that's where the Confrontation Clause violation lies, is that step, that it's Holinka. And to be clear, these are two officers who testified about this one conversation. It's both Soderholm and it's Lacan testify about the conversation between Cook and Soderholm. And they also relay information about the nature of that identification. Soderholm uses words like he was certain, that Cook was certain that that was Holinka. Lacan recounts the same kind of conversation that Soderholm had with Cook. And again, it's repetition that kind of goes to the point with the plain error analysis and the strength and whether or not it affected the jury's verdict. Is that repetition that they used in introducing this evidence through two detectives, not just one, even though it was really just one conversation between Soderholm and Cook? That's kind of why I think it affected the jury's decision so much, is because it was two detectives who discussed this conversation that really was just one single conversation with Cook. It was two experienced detectives. They repeated it. They used language of certainty. The state focused on it in closing as well, saying that's how the identification occurred, was through Cook. And they kind of try to explain away how the Crees, the CIs, didn't identify and come up with reasons, but the state really stresses that that identification that Cook made. And without an ability to cross-examine, Holinka can't expose any motivation, whether or not, you know, I mean, it could potentially be damaging, but he can't cross-examine why Cook provided this. I think the other issue, and as it goes to why this court should correct this error, is the context of this investigation. You have to keep in mind that these are CIs. They're working at the behest of the state. And so the state plays a role in this criminal offense, even though they can't be charged, but they play a role. It's different than a murder or something like that where there would be just two people in the public. So the state started this process by having these CIs go. The CIs relayed what's a pretty vague description. And then the state goes and talks, the police go and talk to another investigator. And so clearly, because the state started this process, they're motivated to see a conviction occur. And I think if you look at a proceeding like this, fundamentally, for the trial to be fair, you have to have a right to cross-examine the witnesses that are called against you. I think if the public looked at that, they'd say, wait a second, the state started the criminal act. They gave money to two individuals to buy drugs. And when those two individuals came back and the identity was in question, we had another witness testify as to the identity without having that witness subject to cross-examination. And that's, I think, where the public integrity of the trial stands in. So for those reasons, I ask that you reverse this case and remand it. Thank you.
Mr. Dahlquist. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing this morning on behalf of Respondent, the State of Minnesota. Before I jump into the sort of the merits of the argument, I do want to address a dispositional issue, how this case should be disposed of, that came up briefly during appellant's argument and is mentioned also in appellant's reply brief. There was some talk about the possibility of a remand if the court thought that there was a need for additional factual record on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And I just want to be clear, a remand is not really possible in this case because there would be nothing to remand. Appellant has never filed a post-conviction petition. And so in cases like this, where appellant raises an ineffective assistance of counsel claim and there needs to be additional factual development, the proper disposition is an outright affirmance, but that affirmance is without prejudice to the possibility of filing a post-conviction petition in the future. Appellant needs to do his investigation for a post-conviction petition, file a petition and the supporting affidavits, and then that issue is before the district court. So I just want to clarify that before I forget to. On the merits of appellant's claim, I take it as my friend's main point in this case is that once the CIs declined to identify the defendant in court, that it, just to use my friend's words, that it would be mind-boggling that you wouldn't pivot your strategy once that happened. And I just disagree with that. And that's because I think if you look at all the circumstantial evidence of guilt from defense counsel's perspective, the case on identification was going to be made even without any in-court identification from anybody. The state was going to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt no matter what. So the failure of the CIs to do that in-court identification wouldn't have changed the strategy. And let me walk your honors through the facts of why I think that's relevant. And Judge Smith, you asked about the facts in the context of a prejudicial impact analysis. Here I want to talk about the facts as relevant to just whether there even was a problematic decision by the attorney. So just be clear, I'm on the error, sort of the error part of the analysis, not the prejudice. So there's sort of three buckets of facts. We have the suspect's description.
I'm sorry. Are you plain error in admitting evidence or ineffective assistance of counsel?
It's sort of both. So for the plain error, you have to sort of look at things from the district court's perspective. And on ineffective assistance, you sort of have to look from counsel's perspective. Mm-hmm. When this discussion of facts, I think, is more relevant to the ineffective assistance. What would counsel have been thinking based on all this circumstantial evidence of identity?
Okay.
So we have the suspect's description as the first bucket of facts. The vehicle description is the second bucket of facts, and appellant's relationship with Corey Flatgard. That's the third bucket of facts. So on the suspect's description, Investigator Soderholm testified that the defendant's address was in Jackson, that he was 6'5" and 180 pounds, and that his nickname was Stretch. And that's the nickname that was provided by the Worthington officer, which is not at issue in this appeal. All of those facts match the description that the CIs provided. They described a drug dealer from Jackson who was a skinny white male between the height of 6'4" and 6'5". So that's a consistent description. Physical description matches. In terms of the vehicle description, Investigator LeCan testified that one of the vehicles outside the residence was a black or dark Ford 500 with a particular license plate number. Investigator Soderholm testified that the vehicle in appellant's driveway was a dark Ford 500, same model, make of car, and had a very similar license plate number, and the jury seemed to really credit that there was the discrepancy was just a notation error. And then appellant admitted that he recently owned and drove a black Ford 500. And then we have appellant's relationship with Corey Flatgard. Corey Flatgard admitted that, or appellant admitted that he had visited Corey Flatgard's home before. He knew Corey Flatgard. And Corey Flatgard testified that appellant visited his home around the date of the charge sale in this case. So from defense counsel's perspective, you take all that evidence, even without any in-court identification, they still have a mountain to overcome on the defense side in terms of attacking the state's proof of identity. And the only way they could have done that is to attack sort of the foundation of the investigation that led to all that circumstantial evidence of identity. And that was the strategy they continued. They wanted to attack the foundation of the investigation, which was once they heard the name Justin Holinka, they proceeded with blinders on and they ignored any of the maybe discrepancies in the evidence that the defense was trying to pick at. So from defense counsel's perspective, once there was the failure to provide an in-court identification, I don't think that it's correct to say at that point there was no reasonable basis to continue this strategy. I think there was still an eminently reasonable strategy. I think it was really the only strategy that was left to the defense. So on the issue of the admissibility or the plain error in the admission of the testimony, again, I think we have to look at this from the district court's perspective. And the district court's perspective on this really comes down to what was the district court told by defense counsel about the defense strategy. And we look to opening statement for that. And in opening statement, the defense told the jury and the district court that they wanted this evidence in. They said this evidence, the fact that someone who was not involved in the investigation, who was not involved in the deal, the drug deal, who had no knowledge about this case, the name Justin Holinka came from that external source. And defense counsel said that's very important to this case. It's very important to our theory of the case. So the district court knows that. The district court knows that the defense is going to be relying on this testimony, relaying the fact that the officers learned the name Justin Holinka from an external source. And so once that testimony is provided, and there's no objection by defense counsel, I think it would be inappropriate for the district court to then, without any request from anybody, jump in and risk intruding upon what the district court has been told is the defense's strategy in this case. So that's why we think there's no plain error. And I don't think the court should reach the question of harmlessness, because I think you really can resolve this on prong two of the plain error test and on prong one of the ineffective assistance of counsel test. unless the court has any questions, I'll rest on my brief and simply ask this court to affirm the conviction.
Thank you. I don't think we do.
Thank you.
We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please, Mr. Dahlquist.
I just have a few very brief statements. I think it's from the Attorney General's perspective, they overstate the strength of the circumstantial evidence in this case. They specifically say Flatgard, who is the individual who was at this house where this thing occurred, provided evidence. And from the trial record, it's clear that Flatgard didn't seem like he had anything to share with the court that was at all reliable. He was vague about every single detail, about even whether or not he had participated in a drug sale in spite of being convicted.
Likewise, the description of the individual who sold to the CIs was vague with the sole exception of the height. And I would note that the Crees did say that the individual was 6'4" to 7 feet. Clearly, they're describing a tall individual, but they're not describing anything else that was noteworthy, whether the person had scars, whether the person had an accent, whether the person had any other distinguishing characteristics. The reason that that's particularly noteworthy is because the two officers who were present, one, Soderholm, he didn't have any visual surveillance of the garage, and two, LaCan, who was watching through binoculars from maybe a block or a block and a half away, described the individual who approached the garage at that time as being white and wearing a hat backwards. Those are not specific descriptors. Mr. Stockmeyer indicates...
Unless you always wear your hat backwards. Wasn't there some testimony that your client generally wore his hat backwards?
I think that's such a... Your Honor, I think that's such a nondescript description. I mean, wear a hat backwards or forwards.
It's a thing up north.
It depends on what you're doing and whether or not you play hockey or something like that. You know, I mean, it's not as if he wore a bright red NASCAR jacket or he had a Harley Davidson Hell's Angels vest. You know, it's not to that degree. And the argument that the defense continued to make this argument that the police proceeded with blinders on, that's actually my argument, is that defense proceeded throughout the entire trial with blinders on and did not pivot at all their strategy off of the fact that the two CIs didn't identify Mr. Holinka. That's the reason that he didn't pivot is, it's evident in the opening statements, but that's before the CIs didn't identify him. And it's clear from the omnibus hearing and the suppression order there that that was what he anticipated, was that the CIs would identify Holinka at trial, and when they didn't, he just continued with that myopic strategy, having blinders on, and didn't pivot away from that.
Why? Once they didn't identify him, why isn't his argument even better from the opening statement that the police only focused on Holinka because they were told that name? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, you talk about pivoting from the opening statement. It doesn't seem that inconsistent with the theory of the case going in. I'm going to tell you that even despite all of this, they maybe would have even landed on Holinka anyway if they followed up on the license plate that they saw, presumably. But even say it was because they heard that.
Well, and to go back to our question exchange earlier in the argument, I think that's what they have to rest on. The rest of the information, the license plate, everything like that, that's circumstantial evidence, and that's not sufficient here to prove the element of identity. It really is that identification that's provided from Cook through Soderholm that gets to beyond a reasonable doubt of the issue of identity. And that is the central problem with the state's case and allowing this evidence in. And that should have been painfully obvious to defense attorney once the CIs don't make that identification, to the court given the procedural posture. So to not recognize that, that's where the plain error occurs.
So the pivot should have been after the CIs testified. Like, if the testimony had come before the CIs, then the court could have let it in. Wouldn't have been plain error. The court maybe wouldn't have had to leap in and unasked for, given the opening statement especially, but after the CI's testimony, the district court said, oh, no, you should keep that out.
Exactly.
So the court should have reevaluated, I guess, the defense strategy based on the testimony that had come in.
Exactly.
From the CIs.
Sua sponte.
But the one thing that I would point out is the court could have raised their hand and they could have summoned both attorneys. There could have been a record made about that. Because it is obvious. Once those CIs don't...
Have you ever seen that in a transcript? I'm just going back through my years on the district court, and I don't think I ever...
So please come up so we can talk about your failure to object on hearsay and your failure to raise a confrontation clause objection so that it's clear you don't want to do that.
I don't think you would...
On the record in front of the client.
Well, I don't think you would say that to the jury or in front of it. But you could just...
Well, I mean, just saying that to the client. I can just imagine what the client would think of... Well,
I think you could just... Your Honor, I think...
I'm not so sure that's a realistic assessment of what the district court judge should have done in this particular case, even if what he did or she did was wrong.
And the one thing that I would say was,
go right ahead.
You could just say something as simple as please approach. Everything doesn't, the thought process of a judicial officer doesn't have to be broadcast to the
and
jury.
And what? Give the defense lawyer a dirty look? Like, do your job? I mean, you know, then you get yelled at for like, well, you're expressing an opinion based on your views at trial by looking at the lawyer and saying, And I think that would have been a different problem.
I think we assume that our judicial officers are going to have a poker face, and although they may be bringing something to the court's attention, and even if they disregard or disagree with the trial court's or trial attorney's performance, they can do so without undermining their ability and their judgment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Dahlquist. Thank you, Mr. Stockmeyer. It was very nice to see you again, Mr. Stockmeyer.